You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to talk about our favorite examples of bands that changed members and got better for it. Really interesting when an established band in the middle of its career, maybe somewhat successful already, makes a change to at least one band member and then just gets exponentially more popular.
Yeah, we were going to call it hostile takeovers, but they weren't always hostile. We'll have some fun with that. But first, we've got some new music to review.
I bought you breakfast, then you started your rings. The air was fragrant and thick with our silence. I held my breath as something deep inside pinched. I touched the bump on your wrist, you were born.
That is a little bit of the song Too Good by Arlo Parks from her first full album, Mr. Cot, Collapsed in Sunbeams. A super talented, young, 20 years old now, musician and poet from West London. With a multicultural background, her dad was from Nigeria, mom was from France and had Chadian background, and she's raised in West London, poetry her first love. Greg, with the release of her first EP, Super Sad Generation 2019, the worst thing that can happen to any singer-songwriter ever happened to poor Arlo. She was branded by the Brits the voice of her generation. An artist of some substance and a wide-ranging interest, from classic singer-songwriter music to, as I said, poetry, steeped in poetry, but also a big fan of Radiohead. So there's interesting production stuff happening in her music. Let's play a song from this album and get into our opinions. I'm eager to hear what you think. I have a lot to say as well. This is Hope by Arlo Parks on Sound Opinions.
Mary tried to talk the pleasure back into being alive. Reminiscing about the apricots and blunts on Peck and Rye. Won't call her friends, 'cause she's ashamed of being locked into bed.
That is Hope, a track from the new Arlo Parks record, Collapsed in Sunbeams. Jim, yes, a lot of hype around this artist right now. And I can understand why. I mean, you know, she is a voice, a pleasant voice of hope, as the song says, at a time when a lot of people are losing exactly that. The multicultural name checks in these songs are legion.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She's got a lot of reference points culturally that she's bringing up. There's a lot of lyrics about plowing through and not giving up and staying, keeping your head above water, and it's going to be okay. I know, because I'm trying to make myself okay. Pleasant enough voice. The music is, you know, I have to say, I think the music is incredibly unambitious.
Really?
It's almost like they want to create a soundtrack that you can invite your parents over and put this on, and nobody's going to be offended in the room. I feel like I could take a bubble bath with this music and probably fall asleep in the bathtub while listening to it.
I think you need a bubble bath, to be frank.
Well, you know, I haven't taken one, but this is the music for it.
Are you
know?
Missing the touches of Radiohead?
I hear a lot of little reference points, but we played a couple of songs that I think are super catchy. And then after about two or three listens, I realized why they are, because the refrains just keep repeating over and over and over again. And I found myself on multiple listens on this album having a harder time getting through it than I did the first time.
Really?
The first time my ears sort of pricked up because he's checking all those boxes that I kind of like. Folk soul, a little bit of trip hop.
A little jazz in there.
Remember India Ari back in the day?
I
thought she was a great artist. A little bit of Lauryn Hill. But I'm thinking of contemporary artists who are addressing these same kind of issues that she is. And more power to her. We need more records about hope. Absolutely. We need more records about self-love and self-care. And delivering that on multiple fronts was that Chicago artist Tasha that we had on the show a couple years ago, I believe, like 2019 probably, before the COVID hit. Even then, it was a time of, you know, an incredible tension in our country. And somebody like Lizzo, who addresses many of these same subjects, but there's tension in the music, there's variety in the music, and what I'm missing in Arlo Parks is a sense of that tension and conflict. I think there's a lot of pleasantness here. It's a very pleasant record. She's got a wonderful voice, but I am not hearing the kind of songs that I want to keep returning to.
I don't know about that. What's interesting to me is that she is not intensely navel-gazing. Her gaze is outward, not inward. She is writing about people in her life that she knows, and she's writing about with a self-consciousness, Greg, that says, yeah, there's nothing more cliched than a young man or woman of 18 or 19 talking about being depressed. So she is doing the Ray Davies thing of sociological observation of people around her. And she's very much clearly one of those people herself, but it's not super self-confessional in that dreaded sweet baby James Taylor way, right? Not even in a Phoebe Bridgers way. And I love Phoebe Bridgers. I think there's humor here you're missing. I think there's a little more sophistication in the production that you're missing. I think she is Lily Allen without the snarkiness, but it's more authentic, more real to me. I love Arlo Parks.
Full moon, put me in the corner, have me swinging with a pool cue. I do this for them rock cues, no money in the lunchroom. My brother's in the magistrates, all they know is hanging, wait and banging till their knuckles break. Mother's safe for peace sake, we could only keep peace safe. Peace up the street with the heat, trying to bleed great. Some people can't see straight, need to find direction. If I clock an interception, Cruyff turn, watch your knees break.
That's a track called Play With Fire from the new Slow Tie album, Tyron. The British rapper Tyron Camone Frampton, otherwise known as Slow Tie, has been all the rage in the British hip-hop scene the last few years. You talk about a voice of a generation, you know, they're attaching that to Arlo Parks. The same kind of treatment Slow Tie is getting. He rose to popularity in 2019 because of his politically charged lyrics. He was naming names, including the then British Prime Minister, Theresa May. He is the voice of the dissent in Brexit-era England. Punky attitude, much about,
walking on stage at an awards ceremony with the severed head of Boris Johnson, replica.
And he had another incident at an awards ceremony where he was called out and canceled, quote-unquote, by the culture because he just went too far.
Lewd comments to the female host.
And I'll spare you all the details, but, nonetheless, Slow Tie has been in a little bit of hot water over the last couple of years, at the same time being an extremely popular artist with his music. The debut was the well-titled Nothing Great About Britain. That's exactly what he felt, and he was expressing it in no uncertain terms on that record. So much anticipated follow-up, Tyron, and he's talking here in a much more personal manner, as you might guess. Here's a track from Tyron before we review it. It's called Feel Away from Slow Tie on Sound Opinions.
We don't go on dates, we went our separate ways, and we don't conversate. She said I'm playing games, she said she feels trapped, stuck up in this maze. How you been? I've been better than yesterday, and it was just a day. You know I don't complain, standing in the rain, soaking wet, trying to demonstrate that I don't feel away. I never hesitate, what's on your mind? Can you say what you're thinking, babe? I'm too sure for my pockets, no, that's bollocks. Walking through my mind, it's a forest, don't get lost again. Said you want a cottage with a fireplace, sitting by the fire with marshmallows and a chocolate fake. You felt low, I took you higher than a note from Mariah, and still you got the cheek to even try and call me liar. One up in the oven, trying to trap me in barbed wire. Put a baby in your stomach if that's what you desire.
That is Feel Away by Slow Tie, a.k.a. Tyron, from his second full album. A fascinating track, that, Greg. It's driven by a little bit of a hooky sample from James Blake. And it's part of the second half of this album. The album more or less divides in two. Club bangers, hard-hitting tracks, kind of snarky, kind of snotty in the in-your-face slow tie way, and then slower introspection. What I like about this guy, now, make no mistake, his outburst against the female host on the award show, some of the things he's done in public, running around in his boxer shorts. You know what? I'm thinking of this kid who is trying to find his way and be authentic and real in the full glare spotlight mm-hmm. of the British music press. Right? He's as famous in the UK right now as famous gets. And he knows he can be a jerk, mm-hmm. and he sometimes is a jerk. What's really astounding about Tyron is this album, he owns up to his worst impulses. He doesn't always stop them, but, you know, he can throw out a line like, living and I'm dead, caught in Charlotte's web, I can't feel myself, mind complexity be the death of me. I'm a man of sweet, I got tendencies, psycho tendencies, touch me tenderly, heaven let me in, I think you got amnesia. Unlike Kanye West, the bum-rushing Taylor Swift incident, and other outbursts mm-hmm. like that. Kanye never was capable of introspection and looking inside himself and wondering why he could be such a jerk. And show me a cocky, talented 26-year-old male who isn't ever a jerk. Mm-hmm. It goes with the species, right? But the track we played in particular, where he's talking about trying to find romantic love in a way that, you know, he previously hasn't, a really kind of light touch production from Mount Kimby, and some great lines. You look low, I took you higher than a note from Mariah. Mm-hmm. He makes you like him in a way that, say, the streets never did, mm-hmm. in a way that Kanye can really drive you away. It's not solipsistic in the way that, like, Drake is. Oh, I'm famous, I'm having problems. There's a humor and there's a realness here.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you to an extent. I think he's a fascinating artist in that he is being even more transparent, if that's possible, on this album. At the same time, the shadow of the, you know, his so-called being canceled, you know, hangs over this record. And, you know, he's referencing it in a couple of songs, most notably in a song called Canceled. You know, to my mind, it's like, why are you even whining about being a celebrity? You're not canceled. You got this record out. You're the most celebrated person
yeah.
in Britain, for bad or good. That's the deal, kid. But I do like the fact that he is showing more of himself, more of what's going on inside. And I think that's kind of a cool progression for this artist. I have to admit, I love the first record more than this one because I just love that punky
the title
attitude. I love the sort of the lineage from The Clash to somebody like Mike Skinner,
yeah.
The Streets, as he was known back in the day. Sort of that voice of the working class, of the downtrodden, of the people who's, you know, seeing the wage gap in England just progressively get worse and worse for the low end versus the high end. I like that guy. That guy expressing that feeling that you have when you're that age.
He seemed like he was putting on an act to me.
I don't think so, man. I think that guy was pissed, and he was showing it in that record. This record, you get some of that vulnerability, and in the second half, you know what really got to me? That in ADHD, that last track, which is kind of, there's a little bit of weepiness and feeling sorry for himself, but that primal scream in there really got me. There's some feeling going into this in this music, the sort of tug of war that he's talking about between his heart and his mind, and it's playing out especially in the second half of this record.
And I say to you again, 26, Greg.
The progression that we're seeing of this artist leads me to believe there's more greatness in store for him.
Well, those are our thoughts on the newest from Arlo Parks and Slow Tie, but we want to know what you think. Tell us on Facebook or Twitter, or leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. After a break, we're going to share our favorite lineup changes, most impactful ever in music. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week we're talking about a phenomenon that's somewhat rare in music, when established groups change one or more of their band members and then go on to make their best work or their most commercially successful work.
We're having a broad definition of this. You're going to lead us off. Well, probably, I know where you're going, probably the most famous lineup changes ever.
Well, yeah, they're the kings and queens of lineup changes in this group. Other than the rhythm section, you know, Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, Fleetwood Mac have been a revolving door of band members since their inception in the 60s. And they're still going today with a different lineup. And McVie and Mick Fleetwood still, you know, anchoring the group. The changes started in the 60s with the Peter Green era group. Peter Green, the guitarist in that band, hired by Mick Fleetwood to play guitar in that group and ended up defining the sound.
Yeah.
He had 3 years there or so where he was just on fire and then just burned out and cracked up. He had a mental breakdown, left the group, and the group reinvented itself again. Its second major incarnation, beginning around the early 70s, was centered on a Californian, a guitarist and songwriter named Bob Welch, and then, of course, the keyboardist Christine McVie, who was married at the time to bassist John McVie. Christine McVie and Bob Welch ended up doing the bulk of the songwriting on many of those early 70s records, and a lot of people have the perception that the group wasn't very successful at that time. They were sort of a cult act. But by the time they made their 1974 album, Heroes Are Hard to Find, they'd cracked the top 40 on the Billboard charts. They'd started to have some commercial success because the songwriting was really good in that group. Mm-hmm. You not only had Christine McVie, but Bob Welch was one of those kind of underwritten personalities in music history, not appreciated fully enough for some of the weirdness he came up with and some of the cool hypnotic vibes. We used to love on the Heroes Are Hard to Find record, what turned out to be his final record with the band, Bermuda Triangle.
Now here's one, you see strange shapes in the light, and shadows in the night. They said that wingtips seemed to brush their faces, and strangers stole their sight. Way down in the triangle.
So these are all kind of these mystical sounding tracks that gave Fleetwood Mac a very distinctive sound, very much different from the Peter Green era Fleetwood Mac.
Right.
So they're sort of progressing along here. But then the band blows up again. Welch leaves. He's burned out. So Mick Fleetwood's desperate for a guitar player and maybe another songwriter.
Yeah.
And then he stumbles into two.
Right.
He meets Lindsey Buckingham out of nowhere in a studio because some producer that he knew played him a track of an obscure duo named Buckingham Nicks and said, this is pretty cool. Who is this guy? Meets Lindsey Buckingham and ends up, Lindsey said, well, you got to, you know, let's bring my partner in too, Stevie Nicks. Lo and behold, they get two songwriters for the price of one. Joining Christine McVie, it's a three-headed monster of great songwriters in that group, and their huge 1975 debut album with that lineup called Fleetwood Mac, appropriately enough. It's like the band starting over for the third time, their biggest record of all time. And it continues to have bigger selling records after that.
Greg, as obvious as Fleetwood Mac is, I'm going to go with an obvious one to start out. Genesis, right? Phil Collins was not even the first drummer in Genesis. It was a real insular crowd of students at the Charterhouse boarding school.
Yeah, right.
You know, Tony Banks, Mike Rutherford, this guy Peter Gabriel, and a great guitarist named Anthony Phillips. A lot of lineup changes in Genesis, too. Phillips is replaced by Steve Hackett down the line. But the first drummer for Genesis is replaced by Phil Collins, and he's an excellent drummer, and they are happy to have him behind the drum set. He has the added benefit of being okay at backing vocals. If you look at some of those ancient Genesis concert shots, you know, Phil is not only playing incredibly complicated drum parts behind a massive set, the microphone is hanging over his head, and he's giving background vocals to Peter Gabriel. But Gabriel became such a theatrical focus and is such a great singer. You know, he really was the star of the band all throughout its early history up to The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, the epic double album concept set.
And the Lamb.
And then Gabriel is burned out and splits in 1975. The band is going to continue. I mean, they've got, you know, killer bassist, guitarist, keyboardist, and Phil Collins, and they are auditioning singers, wondering how they can do anything after Peter Gabriel, especially the press had made him the focus. And in frustration after in a never-ending series of vocal tryouts, Phil Collins said, you know, damn it, give me a shot, I'll just sing this song. It was a song called Squonk, about one of those kind of mythical creatures. The album would become a trick of the tail. It's full of, you know, fairy tale mythology and fun stuff, but getting a little more real than they had been in their early days. And the story goes that Collins did such a great job on this song, Squonk. They recorded it. He continued doing vocals for the whole rest of the album. And of course, there exists a huge generation of fans who only know Collins as the singer. You know, that weird early stuff, Watcher of the Skies and all of that, that Gabriel sang. You know, Collins was the voice of the hits. They continued in the progressive rock vein for some time and then became actually a three-piece pop band with Phil and Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks. You know, I'll defend him up until Abacab, I think, and then I can't really defend much Genesis anymore. But listen to the job he does on Squonk and think back to how different Gabriel's vocals were on Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Phil Collins definitely added some special sauce to Genesis. I mean, it was a different band, but, you know, more power to him. The guy who was never thought of as a singer becomes the singer, and they have more success than ever. It's pretty amazing story.
I meant to insert this for my students and younger bit. That was Emily in Paris's dad.
Okay, that's a very important note to point out. I don't know about James Brown's acting career, but I know he was one of the greatest musicians and artists of the 20th century. And he changed his bands pretty often, or at least personnel in his bands. He was a famously difficult man to work for. Would call out his band members for flaws on stage in front of the entire audience. There was issues with payments. At the same time, he got the best of the best to play with him because everybody wanted to play with James Brown. The guy was constantly innovating, constantly using his musicians in innovative ways. The band he had was called the James Brown Orchestra. That was a band steeped in jazz. Pee Wee Ellis, Maceo Parker, Clyde Stubblefield, give the drummer some, Clyde Stubblefield, Fred Wesley on trombone, bassist Bernard Odom. What a band. And then they all left. They go, James, we cannot work for you
anymore. Too hard
anymore.
Working for you, man.
Yeah, there was some payment issues, and so he lost his band. The James Brown Orchestra basically up and left him. And James
just became the orchestra.
Was unbothered because there was always people he was finding that wanted to play with him. And lo and behold, he came across Bootsy Collins and his brother Catfish Collins. So suddenly the JBs are born, right? And there was a couple of holdovers from the previous band. So he was able to reintegrate these new players into this lineup. This was not nearly the classy outfit the previous band was.
It was a lot dirtier,
but
a lot
funkier.
It was
a lot dirtier, nastier, more raw, and it was perfect for what Brown was trying to do. He was basically reinventing funk yet again. He invented it with Cold Sweat a few years earlier, but now it really got raw and nasty. And that's where you hear a track like Get Up, I Feel Like Being a Sex Machine. You know, that's that is like Bootsy Collins.
Say that again. You said that with such passion.
Get Up, I Feel Like Being a Sex Machine. And that's what Bootsy Collins' bass sounds like on this song. Get up, get on up. Get up, get on up. Get on up. Bobby, should I take him to the bridge? Go ahead. Take him on to the bridge. Take him to the bridge. Can I take him to the bridge? Yeah. Take him to the bridge. Yeah.
sex machine. The way I like it is the way it is. I've got my ticket, he's got his.
So Bootsy and Catfish are playing off each other. James is out front doing what James Brown does. And it's a very different sound. Even though he was approaching this level with something like Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud in 69 with the previous lineup, this thing was a whole lot rawer that he came up with. And both bands were great. You know, there's no doubt about it. But the fact was he just kept building on the success he had with the earlier band with the JB's lineup.
Well, well done, Mr. Codd. I would refer people to the archives to hear our immortal interview with Bootsy Collins. And someday, we're going to put out the outtakes.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Because Bootsy.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Man, Bootsy was a trip. I'm going to England, Greg, in the punk era. 1976, a band forms in Bolton, Buzzcocks. Pete Shelley, the singer-songwriter, guitarist, and singer-songwriter Howard Devoto. People are saying,
yeah.
Who? You know, Howard Devoto was initially Shelley's partner in every way, you know, co-writing the first album, the Spiral Scratch EP. Every song on that album is co-credited to Shelley and Devoto.
Yeah, well, I tell you what I mean. I say what comes to my mind, because I never get around to things. I live a straight, straight line, you know me, I'm acting.
Devoto, in not much time at all after that first EP, decides that punk is getting stale. The quote was, "What was once unhealthily fresh is now a clean old hat." You can hear that in the best song from Spiral Scratch, Boredom. You know, he co-wrote this song, and already, you know, a year into the punk explosion, 1977, Howard Devoto is bored. He leaves the Buzzcocks and goes on to form Magazine, which is a heck of a band. Many consider it the first post-punk band. We've talked about him from time to time. On bass is Steve Diggle, and he moves forward to join Shelley on second guitar, second vocals, and to step into the songwriter role.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point on, Buzzcocks is, Shelley is probably two-thirds of the song, but Diggle's one-third of all the songs that follow are so great, and they make each other better. It's a classic Lennon-McCartney, right. Bob Mould, Grant Hart kind of dynamic. They sing great together. They encourage each other on. You can hear it from the very first significant song that Diggle brought to the Buzzcocks, Autonomy, on Another Music from a Different Kitchen, that first full album. He's firmly in place there as the McCartney or the Lennon, choose one, to Shelley's other guy. It's a great team, but it didn't start out as a team. It became one.
It's a thing that's worth having.
Well, I love the Buzzcocks. No need to convince me that that is a great band. And man, the Diggle Shelley lineup was one of the best of the late 70s.
You know, Pete Shelley no longer with us. Diggle still continuing with a version of Buzzcocks.
Indeed, he is. And as our listeners know, we don't know everything, Jim. So we'd love to hear from colleagues to fill in our blind spots. Today, we're joined by Shannon Effinger, an arts journalist you may have read in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or Pitchfork, among other publications. Shannon, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me.
So you got the concept. We're doing a single lineup change that has taken a band to a whole new place, new level.
Yeah.
Better or worse.
I had several different groups in mind, but for some reason the Temptations kept coming up for me.
Yeah. So what was your entry point to the Temptations?
Oh boy, the early material from them just sort of all runs together. You know, My Girl.
I guess you said, what can make me feel this way? My girl. Talking about my girl.
You know, the way you do the things you do, yes. You know, it's all just like one running thing, but I think the song that initially just stayed with me is just gorgeous on so many levels was probably Just My Imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what's the lineup change that you're focusing on?
So there were two big changes within this song. So David Ruffin was part of the Classic Five, has since been replaced by Dennis Edwards in 68, I believe. But Eddie Kendricks is out on front in this song, and he pretty much is the main vocalist. Like it's a play back and forth between the remaining band members, and you know, almost like a call and response. Like I feel like, you know, Dennis Edwards, Paul Williams, Melvin Franklin, Otis Williams, in this capacity, they're sort of keeping him grounded by saying, you know, this is just my imagination, while Eddie is off, you know, living his full-on fantasy.
They're the Supremes, and this is his Diana moment.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. He wants to.
But it was just my imagination running away with me. It was just my imagination running away with me.
And I think a lot of the change that came about with the Temptations in those years was, you know, varying stories with David's personal problems and and his, you know, sort of contentious relationship with Tammy Terrell. You know, at the time of even recording Just My Imagination, I read that Eddie and Otis weren't seeing eye to eye here. And then soon, you know, Paul Williams, who also, you know, was battling sickle cell anemia and had serious bouts of depression and also alcoholism. So I think it means even more to me knowing that and sort of serves as a point of inspiration that, you know, art really can separate the reality from the sheer beauty of living in your daydreams.
Shannon, that is very well put. We're going to have you on again. But all right.
Oh,
thank you, Shannon. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, Shannon.
We love talking to our colleagues, especially when they are as much fun as Shannon. Thank you so much, Shannon. Coming up, we share more lineup changes and hear feedback from our listeners. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And this week, we are talking significant lineup changes, most that worked out for the best. Greg, you have another for us?
I do, Jim. I'm going to go into Punk Planet now. Henry Rollins with Black Flag. One of the most important bands of its era. And I say this because they may not have been the first punk band, but they certainly were, I think, the most influential early on in the American scene because of the fact that they toured so relentlessly, going from town to town for years upon years, even though the financial rewards were minimal, but inspiring young people in those towns to form their own punk bands and to do the same thing, follow the same itinerary that Black Flag did for
years.
Buy
the junkie van, take off, sleep on friends' floors, coast to coast.
Jump in the van, as Rollins once said in a book title. The point with Rollins was that he actually liked the idea of being the front man and the singer in this group. Prior to that, Black Flag had been going through this revolving door of guys who really weren't sure that they even could sing, much less wanted to. And so that the band was sort of off to a stumbly start. Greg Ginn was an extremely ambitious songwriter and guitar player, really innovative, and couldn't find the right vocalist for the job. Des Cadena was a willing participant. He said, okay, I'll give it a shot, but I really don't want to do this. And in fact, helped hire Rollins.
Yeah.
Had him come up on stage one time when they were playing a gig on the East Coast and said, hey, kid, you know all the songs.
Yeah.
Come on up here and sing this one. and basically says to Greg Ginn, see, this guy can do it.
Well, if ever there was a guy with the requisite ham gene in him to be a front man, it was Henry Rollins.
Well, Rollins, transformed the group. He loved the role of being up in front of a crowd and stirring things up, and the band got in, you know, a lot of tussles because of Rollins' confrontational attitude. But there was more to the guy than just sort of this thuggish kind of, you know, I'm up here to start a brawl. There was some poetry in those lyrics, and there was some ambition musically. Ginn got quickly tired of sort of the hardcore approach to punk, and he wanted to expand in the way he was playing guitar and the kind of music that Black Flag could make. And in Rollins, he found a very willing co-conspirator. So Rollins was right with him. So they had a stretch there where after those early punk singles, like they would do like covers of Louie Louie and things like that early on. Then they couldn't record for a bunch of years because they had some legal issues. When they finally saw those issues, they had this huge stockpile of recordings that they issued in the 80s. I mean, like they were issuing three or four records a year.
Yeah.
And people were having trouble keeping up. And Rollins was right at the center of that. And a lot of the fans were going, what the hell is this? We don't understand this music. It's very different from the sound that they came up with when they came out of the California scene in the late 70s. But Rollins really progressed the band, and they became a much more popular touring entity because of Rollins' presence on stage. So Rollins, you can hear it something like on a track like Best One Yet from that Loose Nut LP in 1985, kind of illustrates where the band was, not only from a musical approach, but from the ambition that was going on in the lyrics as well.
You know, it might be perverse to admit, Greg, but I actually prefer the pre-Rollins Black Flag. A little bit of Henry goes a long way, let me say. But I don't feel that way about Neil Peart. He became so identified with Rush, one of the greatest drummers of the last half century, an amazing technician, also a fine writer. But Neil Peart was not the first drummer of Rush. When that power trio forms in Toronto, the original drummer, John Rutsey, is a fine player. A little more John Bonham, a little more straightforward rock and roll. He is the percussionist powering Rush's first great song, Working Man. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, that's like his anthem. Seems to me. You know what I mean? He was a working class drummer. He was a hard rock guy. He had problems with touring. Wasn't really up to where Rush wanted to go. What a perfect drummer they found after just a handful of auditions in Neil Peart. Rutsey doesn't get all of his credit. Fine drummer for early Rush. Also was writing some of the early lyrics. You know, when Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee went shopping for a new drummer, they also had to find a lyricist. I mean, these two guys are great instrumentalists, but they didn't have the imagination for the lyrics. So they got both in Neil Peart. From the early Dungeons and Dragons mythical, a little bit too much Ayn Rand stuff, you really feel him on Bytor and the Snow Dog, right? You know, he's writing the lyrics. Yeah. It's a grand, you know, swords and sorcery kind of epic, and also an incredible drumming and a much more complex musical construction. And then, you know, there's no looking back from there. Neil Peart's constant invention with Rush over the decades that followed until his untimely death in 2020. You know, John Rutsey died young as well in 2008. But Peart came to define the band with all the lyrical shifts and the musical shifts. And just, you know, wow, what a drummer. Yeah!
Jim, I'm glad you mentioned a drummer, giving the drummer some. Yes. I'm going to give the drummer some more. I think Nirvana became the band that it became because of Dave Grohl entering the band for its second studio album, Nevermind. Not that they were a bad band before, but they've been going through a number of drummers, Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic, and never quite nailing just exactly the guy that they wanted. I mean, Dale Crover was doing a great job for them, the Melvins drummer, but he wasn't going to be part of that operation full-time. So they were going through a bunch of drummers, and they had a guy who was pretty competent. Chad Channing was a good drummer on Bleach, the debut album. Would you believe me when I tell you you're the queen of my heart? Please don't deceive me when I hurt you. Just ain't the way it seems. But there was some conflict there. Channing wanted a bigger role in the songwriting. Novoselic and Cobain, during the demo session for the Nevermind album in 1990, both had some issues with the way Channing was drumming. And whatever they had, the personality conflicts, he got bumped out of the band. He quit, depending on who you talk to. They went to Grohl after this. Grohl was part of the indie scene in the 80s. He was drumming with the band Scream, which Nirvana had become acquainted with on the road in their travels around America. And Grohl, young, hungry, ready for the opportunity, made the difference for that band. I think his drumming on Nevermind was very apparent. Butch Vig loved what he was doing in the studio. But even more so, as a live entity, I think the band just exploded when Grohl joined. I remember seeing the band right after Nevermind had come out at a show at Metro Club Show in Chicago. And it was just like, wow, the electricity in the room when Grohl hit those drums, those sticks starting overhead and landing on the drums in a constant barrage of rhythm behind those great songs and those big melodies. It was just like this band had elevated to another level. So Grohl made a huge difference in when he joined the band in 1990 and on the Nevermind album in 91. And obviously went on to, much success with Foo Fighters afterward. But I think he was never better than when he was the drummer in Nirvana.
And even if you didn't hear the band live with Channing versus live with Grohl, you can hear the difference between the first record, Bleach, and Nevermind.
No doubt.
Well, I got one more, Greg, and it's back to the punk era, although this band, as they proudly proclaimed on their first album, this is pop! XTC, we were just talking about them because we had Todd Rundgren on the show. He produced Skylarking. XTC formed in rural Swindon, England, fronted by songwriters Andy Partridge and Colin Moulding. This is not a musician that made as obvious an impact as some of the others we've talked about. You know, XTC as a quartet was originally completed by keyboardist Barry Andrews. And he had a distinctive sound. Andy Partridge said, when we first met him, he sounded like John Lord from Deep Purple. Mm-hmm. By the time he got into the groove with the band, it was as if Miro was playing electric organ. And I think on the debut album, White Music by XTC, you can hear on a song like This Is Pop, the kind of chaotic keyboards and extra textures he brought to these carefully crafted, super energetic, supercharged pop songs that XTC was doing early in the punk era. This is pop, yeah, yeah. This is pop, yeah, yeah. This is pop, yeah, yeah. This is... But Barry Andrews left after one album, went on to work in League of Gentlemen with Robert Fripp. know, he was much more of a prog rocker, art rocker type, and they tapped a fellow to replace him named Dave Gregory. Dave makes his debut on the great single, early XTC hit, Life Begins at the Hop. You may not necessarily hear what he's doing. He's a second guitarist, he's a keyboardist, he's the texture guy. from that point in 1979, Life Begins at the Hop, all the way through 1999, Gregory was the guy who colored in between the lines. If Andy Partridge always was the primary singer-songwriter, and Colin Moulding, a great songwriter, again, contributing about a third of the material, all you know, up to Andy's level, but Andy was more prolific, Gregory is the guy that was the glue. For a long time, they didn't even have a drummer in later years, and Gregory was the guy in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Partridge, hard to work with, mercurial, difficult by all accounts, including his own. You know, Gregory kept that band a going concern and did a lot of wonderful texture stuff that made the group so great. I don't think anybody can deny that.
Going deep with that choice, Jim. I like it a lot. And we have done our part on these significant lineup changes. Now we want to ask our listeners to contribute as well. Are there other good lineup changes we left out? Let us know by leaving a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. You never know. Your message might be used on the show in a segment just like this.
New messages.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Sarah from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you so much for your show about Todd Rundgren. I really enjoyed it. It also reminds me of the song from 1970, We Gotta Get You a Woman, Leroy Boy.
Leroy Boy, is that you? I thought your post-hanging days were through. Sunken eyes and full of sighs. Tell no lies.
Such good memories. Your show has been so important to me for decades, and especially in this whole last year, you make my week. Thank you, guys. Love you.
Hey, Jim and Greg. Just want to call in to give my feedback on the Mistakes episode, which was fantastic. An apology that is truly felicitous, in the words of J.L. Austin, our great philosopher of ordinary language, who explained to us how speech acts work, requires the person making the apology to recognize that they have, in fact, made a mistake. And you guys really, in your discussion, really, really recognize that. And I'm speaking from a little bit of authority here. I study language, and I study meaning in particular. I'm a member of the Department of Linguistics, University of Chicago. My own addition to the group of songs, great songs that you guys all recommended, would be to throw in Wait Until Tomorrow from Axis Bold as Love, which is not, strictly speaking, a song about a mistake or an apology, but the great thing about this song is it's about someone who is afraid to make a mistake or afraid to regret something. Finally, her lover says, well, I can't wait anymore. And then he moves on.
Oh, Dolly Mae, how can you hang me up this way? On the phone you said you wanted to run up with me today. Now I'm standing here like some turned-down serenading fool. Hearing strange words settled from the mixed-up mind of you. And you keep telling me that's a... Take it right away, till tomorrow.
So thanks for a great episode. Glad to be a Chicagoan supporting your show.
In 1965, I was a freshman in college. We ended up in the middle of a snowstorm in the local town's record shop. Browsing the albums, I found one that just grabbed me. A plain blue cover with the title Collection. It was cheap, 75 cents, I think. And I bought it, and it changed my life. It was a bunch of blues. I had been a radio listener, but had not ever heard Delta Blues, Lightnin' Hopkins.
Long gone, like a turkey through the corn.
Bobby Blue Bland, James Cotton. Like so that was my baptism into the blues. It's never left me, and I love you guys, so keep it up.
No more messages.
Greg, it is always great to hear from our listeners. Thank you for giving us your feedback. Thank you, Andrew Gill, for putting that together. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to talk about the independent label Fortune Records, which was a goldmine of great, if underappreciated, music in the Detroit scene for decades.
And even better stories. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne and our intern, Sol Delgadillo.
Yes, I'm going.